right, this is the Documentation of the Clown World. I mean, Pure Decking, show number 529 for Thursday, July 27th, 1981. This is a show about stuff that interests me, like information security, rigging the game, and using the internet to hide from the internet. Tonight we have a madman. What's up, madman?
Hello. Are you happy about the Twisted Metal movie, too?
I'm just... You know, of all the games out there they could make into movies, you know, they're picking some weird ones.
Yeah, I didn't really know that there was a plot line behind that game. I just, you killed people because racing can get boring, but if you shoot them, it's not boring.
I always thought the plot line to Twisted Metal was right up there with the plot lines to the Quake games, which is, here's a bad guy, go shoot them. I mean, actually, the hilarious part is apparently they id guys had these deep plot lines for these games. They just don't really come across in the game. So, and we have an RU. What's up, RU?
Well, what's up is we're now the third highest taxed for sin taxes in the world.
Well, who's one and
as
two?
As of yesterday.
Then?
Two Nordic countries. I think two countries that have like 6 months of darkness.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, alcohol went up again this week, I think. Yeah, now we're the third highest for sin taxes. We'll soon be number one. If we keep going this way, we'll be number one by next year.
You're number one. You're number one.
Get him a big foam finger.
It's all right. They're complaining about the black market on alcohol and tobacco right now. Like, stop. Stop creating a black market.
Well, then quit taxing the shit out of it.
That's not what creates... They do know it's the taxation that creates a black market.
No, it's the people, Madman. It's the evil people.
Madman, you remember our conversations the other day where I said the government was not run by easy to understand or, you know... intelligent people.
Not run by rational people.
Rational, well, that was the word I was digging for, yeah.
But what they need to do if they want to get rid of the black market is to convince people that the taxes are going to a worthy cause and that the government isn't corrupt.
Good luck.
There are two things that fuel a black market. One is overtaxation, and two is lack of trust in the government. Is that lack of trust what, you know, really makes people think they're being overly taxed?
I just want them to, you know, get some racial equality in the black markets there. You know, if, you know, it shouldn't be a black market. It should be a, you know, representative
a rainbow
of the
coalition.
Yeah, there you go.
Criminals.
I can't finish the joke. I don't know how to land one.
You know, it's fucking absurd. But yeah, so you might like to know that one.
Can we go back to figuring out what video games would make good movies? That was much less depressing. Saints Row.
I can't wait for them.
The Saints Row
games. I
can't
wait for them to really start raiding the Mattel toy line for stories. It's going to be great.
Well, I mean, apparently the Barbie movie.
G.I. Joe, they already did that.
Oh, they can remake it, Madman. Put your faith in there.
Oh, they're looking at a Hot Wheels movie as well. Which fuck, I just thought that was Days of Thunder with Tom Cruise.
That's
a fucking Hot Wheels movie. Death Race. Also, another Hot Wheels movie.
Yes.
I guess technically Fast and Furious would fall in that area too.
Yeah. Hot Wheels didn't get that ridiculous.
Cannonball Run.
So.
Yeah.
Well, they just made the Mario movie, so I understand why, and that one actually did well, so I understand why other studios are looking at video game plots, but it's just like, Twisted Metal is such an odd choice. I mean, it's got to be so they can go nuts with VFX.
That's all it is.
Yeah. Instead of an alien invasion or a superhero, it's a video game, so I guess that makes sense. But, You know, I guess what they really ought to be doing is raiding old dead IPs, because a lot of companies got snapped up. Well, EA owns a lot of them now, though, so it's probably hard. So I was going to say, the Red Alert games would be hilarious if made into a movie. Because they don't make sense anyways, so why not?
The old Atari games used to come with little mini comics to explain their video games.
Yeah.
One of the Alien Invasion ones.
Yards
the graphics
Revenge,
are so shit that you can make the alien look like anything, and they'll be like, that's from the video game!
Well, you just have to have that one scene where they're looking at it through a bad digital camera or something, and it's like super zoomed in so it's blocky and kind of looks like the sprite from the game. Then, yeah, you resolve the image, it looks like whatever you want, so... But, what was the one game? Pitfall, the movie. Pretty sure they've made two, but it's called
Tarzan.
Did
they make a movie?
Huh?
They make a Pitfall movie?
Oh, they might have. Fuck, I don't know.
Fuck, now I gotta check.
Trying to think of obscure games that could be made into, like, Jungle Hunt on the Commodore or something, right?
Oh, the new Western, Oregon Trail, Everybody Dies of Dysentery.
Yeah, but then they have to show somebody dying of dysentery. I don't know. I don't want
to... Hey, after the ending scene of Bone Tomahawk, I am ready for anything.
Well, as long as there's not... never mind. I'm just going to leave that where it is. Well, let's get into making fun of Elon Musk. This story's from Ars Technica. Elon Musk's decision to rebrand Twitter as X wouldn't be complete without a change to the company's official Twitter account. The @X handle had already been taken by a user who registered it over 16 years ago. But that wasn't much of an obstacle. Twitter simply took over the username and offered its longtime owner some merchandise, but no monetary compensation.
Oh, no, I want $1 million.
Well, this is the problem of relying on other people's platforms. San Francisco-based photographer Gene X. Huang was @X on Twitter from March 2007 until yesterday. Quote, they just took it, essentially, kind of what I thought might happen, Huang told The Telegraph. Quote, they did send an email saying that it is the property of X, essentially. They just took it. They literally sent him an email saying, your username is our property, fuck off. Huang confirmed to Ars today that, quote, there was no financial compensation, unquote, offered to him. The company offered to, quote, switch the @X account and its history and followers to a new handle once he selects one that is available. I shouldn't have been changing that because it was a quote. Once I select one that is available, unquote, Huang told us, quote, they offered some merch and to meet with the management team as well, unquote. Huang said he doesn't feel any need to meet with management since he's not sure what that conversation would be. The meeting would probably be awkward, he said. The former @X account holder has no plans to fight the change. Huang told Ars, I am definitely not a legal expert and I am not sure what my rights are. There are. He wrote in an email, adding that, quote, maybe there is something there, but I don't really want to fight that kind of fight as I like to keep my life more simple, unquote. So he's just going to lay down and take it. Huang is still on Twitter with the new handle of @X12345678998765. All's well that ends well, he tweeted last night. He told Ars that the @X number string is the handle Twitter moved him to temporarily before he picks a new name. Huang said he did, quote, didn't need to hear from Mr. Musk directly, but it would have been nice to have gotten something for the account, unquote. He views any compensation as, quote, more of a nice-to-have bonus, unquote, rather than a requirement. He said, quote, maybe I should ask for the blue bird they are taking down from the headquarters building sign since it's no longer Twitter anymore. Or if Fred suggests asking for a Tesla Model X or a ride on SpaceX. Well, yeah, give the guy a car. Fuck, they're having a hard time moving him anyways.
Oh, ride on
Fuck,
SpaceX.
Why put
cool
a financial
too?
Burden on the guy?
Yeah, well,
you're cruel, Morps.
Well, you know that. But anyways, before the @X handle was taken away, Huang said he would be willing to give it up in exchange for payment. Quote, I am waiting to see what might happen, unquote, and quote, I'd be willing to part with the handle if they made an offer for it that made sense, unquote. He told TechCrunch earlier this week. No one from Twitter reached out to him before the company rebranded as X, he also said. Huang was quoted as saying several years ago that he turned down offers as high as $40,000 because he didn't think they were legitimate. Quote, I didn't really entertain any of them seriously, unquote, he said at the time. Twitter's official account was formerly at Twitter, but the profile says, quote, this account is no longer active. Follow @X for updates. The @X account is now populated with years' worth of tweets that originally appeared on the @Twitter account, giving the impression it was X all along. Twitter says it can take over any username in its terms of service. Quote, we may also remove or refuse to distribute any content on the services, limit distribution or visibility of any content on the service, suspend or terminate users, and reclaim usernames without liability to you, unquote, the Twitter terms say. That line was already in the Twitter terms before Musk bought the company. Usernames can have monetary value. The owner of Naoki Hiroshima wrote in 2014 that he'd been, quote, been offered as much as $50,000 for it, unquote, and that people have, quote, tried to steal it, unquote. One hacker was successful in taking control of @in, but Twitter later restored the handle to Hiroshima. In January, a New York Times report said that Twitter has considered selling usernames to generate new revenue as its owner, Elon Musk, tries to resuscitate the company's business. Under Musk, Twitter also has gotten much more aggressive about purging accounts that seem to be inactive. So, yeah, I mean, that's not surprising that it's in the terms of service that they own it because, again, somebody else's service, right? So, this is, you know, there is, this is where things get a little weird on the internet, right? Because if your system and account all lives on Twitter servers, it's kind of hard to argue that you own it. Whereas, like with a domain name, you're paying a registrar for it, but you are considered the legal owner. So for the whack of domains I have, including the G15 and the Galaxy 15 domains, they're registered with privacy protections enabled. Well, because back when we started this thing, I was, you know, pretty concerned about that. But also, I've owned domain names before, and if you register them with real information, the amount of bullshit phone calls and junk mail you get is absurd. And that was 20 years ago. I can only imagine what it is today, the way they do data farming.
Oh, yeah, they assume you're a business.
Yeah.
Like, they're going to sell you everything corporate that they can.
Dude, one of my first domain names, I was still living with my parents when I had registered it. And I was getting shit in the mail from, it was a scam. But they were saying they were going to sue me for the domain name because it was part of their trademark unless I gave them, you know, some absurd amount of money. You know, it didn't take long to dig into them and say, yeah, these are fake. But yeah, I mean, you just get the most asinine bullshit if you put real information in there. So you have to use the privacy thing for the registrations. Not you know, even if you don't have anything to hide, just because the sheer amount of bullshit that you get from being in the Whois database. But even so, my registrar has to have up-to-date information for all of it because I own the domain names. They're mine. I'm paying for them. So, whereas with Twitter, it's not a contractual arrangement that you own this chunk of namespace in a system. It's, you've got a system on their account. It's their system. I don't doubt that it says in the terms of service that they own the usernames. I also don't doubt that somewhere in that terms of service says that they can update it at any time without any prior notice. Because almost every terms of service has that one in there too. So if the line about owning usernames wasn't in there, they could have added it, waited 15 minutes for the page to refresh, then taken the domain name. And if he tried to do anything with it in court, they were like, well, we say we can update the terms and conditions any time. We updated the terms and conditions. Pray we don't update it further. So, you know, that's always something I wonder about with, like these big-name YouTube channels, right? They, you know, yeah, they've got a big channel on YouTube, and that's, like, that's like their livelihood. Same thing with, like, Twitch and things like that. You know, what if the company in charge just said, you know what, that username's worth a lot of money. Yoink, and put it on the auction house for the highest bidder. Now, would that destroy the value of the channel? Immediately. Of course it would. But people are short-sighted and stupid, and you think there wouldn't be a company that pulled that shit?
On that one, I don't see YouTube doing it because they're making money off that guy's channel.
Again, we're talking
about reasonable
people.
They're making as much or
people.
More.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, what if YouTube was not doing so well? You know, what if Google decided to cut it free, said, you're your own company, go away. We're costing too much money.
I could see them taking usernames from failing channels that the username's good, but the channel's crap.
Yeah, I could see that. I could also just see them charging people. You know, I mean, that's the thing, though, is if once you're in that contractual agreement to own a name, it's a different game. Because now it's a contract. It's not just an in-service agreement. Technically, a user license agreement is a contract, but it's pretty... I mean, you know, there's no negotiation. There's no back and forth. It's not treated the same way. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, an actual contract, you know, the courts will consider a contract invalid if both sides don't have some benefit from it. They'll say, oh, well, obviously they just didn't understand what they were signing. You lied to them about it. That's fraud. So, you know, they'll throw that shit out. But
there was no meeting of the minds, I believe, is the legal term for that.
Yeah. Whereas with an end-user license agreement, you're agreeing to something to access the system. You know, at the end of the day, they can just kick you out of the system. It's their system. So, you know, if you don't have anything you're bringing to the table other than just your usage of the system, it's pretty easy for them to argue that just kick you out. You know what I mean? But if you were paying for it, that's different.
Now, one thing with at least the YouTube example, everyone I know that thought that they might have big names or had big names had trademarked what ended up being their channel names in other places.
As a way to help protect it, sure.
And that makes sense. That was their pretty much their brand.
Yeah.
So YouTube may own crap. Why am I blanking on all of them now?
It's
I was
fun.
Thinking Alex Jones's channel was actually named after his radio show and his corporation. So they might own that channel on YouTube, but they only can use it on YouTube.
Right. No, that's absolutely the case. Yeah, especially if you've got trademarks and stuff involved. So... And again, domain names is an easy example to point to because companies have successfully sued people if they think somebody's, you know, squatting on a registered trademark or a registered brand name, right?
Oh, yeah, if you're too close to Walmart.com, you're
yeah, they'll try
waiting
to get the
for a lawsuit.
You. Yeah. Well, the classic example was a gentleman named Mike, last name of Rowe, who developed his own software. And so he had a username, or he had a domain name of Mike Rowe Soft. Of course, it was R-O-E-W-E, I believe. Not, you know, Mike Rowe as in small. It was Rowe as in the dude's last name. And Microsoft sued him for the domain. And their lawyers, but you know, their PR people put out a statement saying, yeah, it's unfortunate. We didn't want to do this, but our trademark lawyers told us we had to.
Which what I love bullshit. About that lawsuit, if you looked at his site, the front page on his site was pretty much a disclaimer saying, I am not Microsoft Corporation.
Yeah.
And then in smaller font, there were the options for his site. So he made it as obvious as humanly possible that he was not Microsoft.
Well, that's why that one's the classic case, right? And Microsoft still took the domain from him. And, you know, I don't doubt that if some company came along and was big enough and happened to happened to have a name collision with one of the domains I owned, you know, am I going to have much luck defending against them, even if I can show that I've owned some of these domains for decades?
It depends on how old the company is, because you mentioned Microsoft, but there's a really cool court case involving McDonald's.
Well,
McDonald's
a,
restaurant?
Yeah. Oh, you're talking about the McDonald's in Kentucky that was that predates McDonald's moving into Kentucky. The
predates
the,
McDonald's existing in California where they started.
Yeah.
And McDonald's has to pay that restaurant royalties for using the name in the state of Kentucky.
Yeah. There's another case that came up with domains. I think this was probably about 8 or 9 years ago now, where there was a security podcast. I used to listen to it. The original, it was originally called Paul.com, and he had had that domain for 10 years before I ever, you know, listened to him. And he had to change the name of his podcast because somebody else started up a company called Paul.com. The company was only a couple of years old but had registered all of the trademarks, sued him, and he lost in court. In court, they said, well, you're, you know, even though you've been using this domain longer than the other companies existed, they've got the trademark on it. You don't. And I'm guessing it's because he probably never thought to trademark his, you know, name. So, you know, it's stupid, and I imagine, you know, it's technicalities and probably who's got a better paid lawyer. But, yeah, I mean, it's one of those things of, I understand why the guy was like, I'm not going to fight Twitter for the username. I mean, I understand it. I'd, you know, kind of take the opportunity to at least needle them for it, you know? But
The Twitter one, I think's kind of crap.
It is crap.
But I understand, at least on the Microsoft one, and the reason I'm understanding of that is the way our legal system is set up, if you don't defend your trademark, you can lose your trademark.
Yeah, but it wasn't their trademark. It was his name. It wasn't spelled the same. It only sounded the same spoken out loud.
Yeah, and with trademarks, that's close enough. Like the Nike Swish, if I put two stars above it and no one challenges it, I'm weakening Nike's trademark. It makes it easier to encroach upon it.
Well, and that is, you know, that's, you know, the flip side of that is when, you know, somebody's brand becomes synonymous, you know, with a verb, like Kleenex.
Oh, Googling.
That's the classic example. You know, you can't, it's not facial tissue. Everybody calls them Kleenex to the point that they've actually lost their trademark on Kleenex because everybody use it, like, you know, for any generic.
Yeah, it's not a cotton swab, it's a Q-tip.
Yep. So, I don't know. I know it just kind of swings both ways, and I know it depends on the lawyers, so it's just... But, yeah, I mean, the Twitter one's crap. It is absolute crap. Does that mean Twitter was not within their legal right to do that? No. Well, X now, I guess. Yeah, they're able to do it. It's legal. It's still wrong. Shitty thing to do.
Yeah, because they weren't defending a trademark. They were making one. They should have compensated the guy.
Yeah, I mean, you know.
Even if it's an attaboy and a $500 check.
Right? I mean, that would have been something. I mean, well, not only that, but the whole Twitter's wanting to start some kind of a compensation program for content similar to YouTube. I mean, shoot, he would have been a good example and a test case for their system. It's like, here, we're buying your username. You don't get a choice in the matter, but we're at least going to give you something for it, you know? Eminent domain it. But no, they just took it. Which, again, is not surprising because they could. It's like, you're not wrong, you're just an asshole. So. Anyways.
What's next up on the chopping block?
This one's from Torrent Freak. Two photographers who filed a copyright lawsuit against Instagram after their images posted to the platform appeared on BuzzFeed News and Time via embedding have lost their case. An opinion handed down Monday, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit referenced its 2007 server test precedent, noting that Instagram could not be liable for secondary copyright infringement because when content is embedded, no copy is made of the underlying content. So, in common with content created in other fields, photographs generally enjoy protection under copyright law, allowing photographers to determine who can duplicate and distribute their work. Photographers Alexis Huntley and Matthew Brauer, I think it's Bauer, but it looks like it's A and R is transposed, so I don't know if that's a typo or if that's a, I don't know how to say that name, posted several of their copyrighted works on Instagram. In January of 2016, Time published an article titled, "These Photographers Are Covering the Presidential Campaign on Instagram." Within that article, Time embedded one of Brauer's Instagram posts, which contained a copyrighted photograph of Hillary Clinton, to which Brauer owned the copyright. In June of 2021, during Black Lives Matter protests, BuzzFeed News published an article titled 17 Powerful Pictures of Protest Through the Eyes of Black Photographers. Within that article was a photograph taken by Alexis Huntley, displayed via embedded post from Huntley's Instagram page. Time did not seek permission from Brauer or Instagram to embed the photograph of Hillary Clinton. BuzzFeed News did not seek permission or attempt to license Huntley's photograph taken during the protests. Outrage at losing control over where their works appeared, Huntley and Brauer filed a class action lawsuit against Instagram for allowing their images to be displayed on third-party sites without permission from the copyright holder. The photographer's main target was Instagram, which Huntley accused of intentionally and brazenly encouraging and assisting third-party sites to display copyrighted works while making no effort to stop the rampant infringement. The complaint accused Instagram of inducement of copyright infringement, contributory copyright infringement, and vicarious copyright infringement. Time and BuzzFeed News stood accused of violating Huntley's right of display. Huntley sought damages from the alleged infringement and an injunction to prevent further violations. At the district court, the complaint was found to have fundamental flaws, which Instagram laid bare in its motion to dismiss. At BuzzFeed News, the location where Huntley's image was displayed, there could be no violation of Huntley's exclusive display right under the Copyright Act. To be found liable, the alleged infringer must display a copy of a copyrighted work. In this case, the photographs were embedded and were always stored on Instagram's servers. The district court comments as follows. BuzzFeed and Time do not violate Instagram users' exclusive display rights because they do not store the images and videos. They do not fix the copyrighted work in any tangible medium of expression. Therefore, when they embed the images and videos, they do not display copies of the copyrighted work. All of Huntley's copyright claims alleged secondary liability, but such claims cannot exist when there is no direct infringement. Huntley's original and first amended complaints both stated that Instagram hosted the images that proved terminal as far as the district court was concerned. In February of 2022, Huntley was denied leave to amend the complaint because the deficiencies were simply too great. The case was dismissed and Huntley appealed. In an opinion published on Monday, the court references its own decision in the Perfect 10 versus Amazon Inc. case in 2007. Perfect 10, a publisher of copyrighted nude images, alleged that Amazon and Google infringed its rights when they displayed thumbnail images of Perfect 10's photographic works. Google did not host or store the main images that appeared in the user's web browsers, as they were embedded from the source servers, just like the photographer's posts were on Instagram. Quote, applying the server test to the facts, we conclude that Google's inline linking, what we now call embedding, did not display a copy of Perfect 10's copyrighted images, as that term is defined in the Copyright Act, the opinion reads. Quote, although Google may have facilitated the user's access to infringing images, we concluded that such assistance does not constitute direct infringement. Huntley argued that the server test should not apply to social media platforms, but since Perfect 10 states the rule for infringing the public display right uses an embedding, the argument was not considered. The opinion does rule out both direct and secondary infringement. So there's nothing else to the story there. They've got some quotes, but yeah, basically by posting the photographs to their public Instagram profile, Hunley stored a copy of those images on Instagram servers by displaying Hunley's images. Instagram did not directly infringe Hunley's exclusive display right because Instagram had a non-exclusive sub-license to display the photos. But Instagram, or because BuzzFeed and Time embedded but did not store, they are not guilty of direct infringement. Which is, I mean, a hell of a technicality.
I think Instagram should be fine because I don't see them.
Yeah,
ever
you posted
being
it
violative.
There.
You put it there.
Yeah.
I think that it was wrong to apply it to Time not violating it.
I think because here. The problem is that the law is outdated and you are dealing with the technical back end of how these systems work versus what the end user perceives. Because if I write a blog post and I embed shit from Twitter and I embed shit from Instagram, as far as the user viewing the page is concerned, that stuff's in my article, you know, whatever it is I'm referencing, right? Whether or not it's a extra copy of it made on the server somewhere, technically it's copied into your browser's cache whenever you look at it. So if you want to get stupid technical with how this stuff works, anytime you look at a copyrighted image on your computer, you've made a local copy of it in your browser's cache, and you've likely made a couple of other copies of it just based on how the operating system in the browser works. You know, there's also a copy of it in memory that, you know, it may or may not be written out to the hard disk. I mean, if you want to break down that kind of technicality versus just what the end user sees. And the problem is that's a hard argument both ways. Because I can see where you want to argue on these technicalities of how a system works and where you don't. And where do you apply the test is hard to determine.
On this, I would go with, is it a function of the system? Like, the copying it to my RAM so I can actually view it.
Yeah, that's how the system works.
A function of perception, because when Time embedded it in their article, they weren't doing it for their article to work. They wanted to use the picture, as in what would normally have been calling up the photographer and paying him $1.75 or whatever it is for one-time use in their article.
But yeah, because they use the built-in embedding system in Instagram rather than right-click, save as, you know.
Yeah. So on the whole function, I see it as different, and they could have written an opinion to reflect that. And gone after and said Time owes money, or the other news agency. But yeah, the host that he posted his picture to, those guys are free and clear. Or should be free and clear.
Oh, I'm sure Instagram has some legal mumbo-jumbo that, you know, by posting your pictures to them, they have a non-exclusive, perpetual, we can do what the fuck we want with this license. Because usually they say something along those lines if you go look at any content host. And that, you know, perpetual, you know, unencumbered, blah, 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 blah license that, you know, is in there. It's purely so you can't do exactly what this guy is doing, saying, oh, I posted this to Instagram, and now they violated my copyright, I want to sue them. Well, how did they violate the copyright? Well, they've displayed it on their web servers. Well, if you didn't want them to display it, why'd you post it? You know? this comes up for the very practical question of, if you create something and post it online, do you really expect to have proper copyright protection? I mean, I know some people do, but I mean, the sheer existence of the number of pirate streaming sites that are out there should kind of argue otherwise. And that's from big media companies that are really trying to prevent people from copying their stuff failing. You really think if you post something to the internet, you have any kind of expectation of copyright protection?
Not real. You don't own shit.
I think you have an expectation. I just don't think that it's going to be practical that you can enforce it.
Well, it's the same reason. Well, it's the same reason in California they find the fuck out of businesses for putting stuff on the sidewalk, but they don't hassle the homeless people. The businesses have money. The homeless people don't.
Oh, no, it's because they're idiots. They could clean up the homeless problem.
No, I know that, but I'm saying for where they're issuing fines and where the agents are doing the work. And I'm saying that because it's the exact same thing with this copyright protection. Sure, go after the pirate sites. Do they actually have very much? Probably not. Just whatever they're making in ads, and it's probably not that much. Versus, you know, it's like when Nintendo sued that Gary Bowser guy where he's going to have to give them so much money out of his paycheck the rest of his life. And, you know, they're never going to see all the money they want in court. They know that. They don't care. They're sending a message. But at the same time, you know, if Netflix was posting a bunch of videos from Disney Plus, you think Disney wouldn't have them in court the next day?
Oh, yeah. I know everything that Disney owns a copyright to, Netflix has paid a license for. Because Disney will have them in court the very next day.
You can pick apart the specifics of the example and not you with that. You know the point I was trying to make. The fact that they had a license that you were aware of that I wasn't doesn't change the point. That Disney would sue Netflix over the pirate sites because Netflix has pockets to be worth suing.
It's not just pockets. They know who to sue.
That too. That's a very good point.
Because that's the big problem with pirate sites. It's not that it's not worth going after the little guy, because it is. It's just being able to go after the little guy. Because I set up my pirate site in, I don't know, Russia. How likely is Russia to really obey American copyright right now?
Depends on how bored they are.
Madman, it's not a pirated site. It's an archiving site.
Archiving site, yes.
Yeah. You don't do anything. Like, I'm watching an archived version of Silence of the Lambs right now. It's not pirate. It's archive.
We're internet librarians. We're simply archiving it for you.
Exactly. If they can fucking move the language around, so can we. But the last 40 minutes been talk everything. No one owns shit when it comes to digital. You don't have any rights. They would change the fucking user agreement that day if they have to fuck you over. If you can't hold it in your hand or hang it on the wall, you don't own shit. That's how you got to think of the internet. Like all the Steam games I have, I don't own shit. You know? That's at the luxury of Steam. I play games at their bidding, you know? Like, they control it.
Tell you what,
that is one problem with the modern digital economy. Whereas when I used to buy all of my albums, which music I still mostly own physical copies of, but I could give that to people, bequeath it when I pass away. My Steam library, I mean, I don't think they'll notice that I'm dead until, you know, the 400th year of somebody logging into my account, if Steam lasts that long. But there's no legit way of passing on any of the stuff you purchased.
Well, that's the thing, even with digital purchases of music, you can still burn them off to CD or save them out on SD cards or whatever hardware format floats your boat. Run the things out the audio jack to tape for, you know, if you want to take the time to do it. 3D print a frickin' record out. Well, that would be hard. Maybe on a resin printer. I was going to say, that'd be a trick. Convert an audio file to a model that you could print a record album on, like one of the high resolution printers. Might be something to look into later, just as a gag. But, you know, that kind of stuff, but you still have to go through the effort of, you know, burning the music off, getting it back into a medium that you can control. I don't know how you do that with a Steam game. I think you can, in some cases, back up the install, but you don't really have an install disc like you used to get back in the day. You know, when I bought Quake 2, it came with a CD with, you know, four of the little logos kind of arranged around it, and, you know, you could install the game from the CD. You know, now if I go to install something off of, Steam, it blows it on the hard drive, but I don't have any way to back up that. I mean, I can just back up the files, but I don't know that that's always going to work if I'm, like, moving to another computer or something, you know?
Well, I'm building a XP machine right now. Mm-hmm. It'll be air-gapped just to play old games.
Yeah? Well, with the XP, around XP, you got to be careful because of, that's when you were starting to see some of this copy protection that might as well have been malware, loading it up from the physical copies of the games, so...
Yeah, I'm aware of that, I guess.
Yeah.
Oh, and one bitch thing Steam does, if you own a physical copy of a game and you load it onto a computer that has Steam running, it will link that game to that Steam account and give it ownership of that game as far as Steam's concerned. I lost a copy of Command & Conquer to a friend of mine because of that.
Wow.
Now, he's a friend of mine and is like, dude, I wanted that game anyway. And he gifted me Command & Conquer on Steam.
But now your copy of Command & Conquer is permanently in Steam. You don't have a physical copy anymore.
Yeah.
Some of the games, you can view the CD keys. So if you could get your hands on the CD image, you know, from an archivist website, perhaps, you can... go into Steam and get some of the CD keys, but not all of them. Like, you know, what was the game that you all told me to get today? It's the stat. I think Static told me to get it. Zombie Army. Here we go. Can I actually view the CD keys for this game? Let's see, because it's a fairly new game. Nope, I don't see any way to get them. To see. Steam, get your CD key. Select the game. Right in the settings icon, manage CD keys. Okay. Let's see. Yeah, no, there's no CD key here. So this is just tied to a Steam account, and I, you know, and if Steam goes, you know, something happens and Steam goes out of business tomorrow, yeah, the 40-some-odd bucks I just spent on this game, yeah, well, sucks to be you, because it's just gone.
I don't even cling to it anymore, man. If I wake up tomorrow and my Steam account's gone, I don't care. Done.
Fair enough. You know,
I don't give two fucks about digital shit anymore, man.
So let's get going.
I still kind of do. I'm vindictive. I will not buy a fucking Sony game because I lost $35 to them. Fuck Sony.
Dude, fuck, I'm the same with Ubisoft, man.
For $35. And I spend that on fucking booze at a bar, don't even think about it. But they screw me out of just...
It's not the money, it's the principle of the thing.
Fuck them.
Yeah, fuck Ubisoft, man. I'll never play another Ubisoft game again.
Only had one game, can't retrieve it, fuck them. And that's DC Online, if anyone cared. Fuck you.
Oh, I know what the problem was, because I ran into that problem with them too. They truncate your password and don't tell you. They chop it off after 11 characters.
That could be a possibility.
No, seriously.
Okay.
If you remember what that password was, only type in the first 11 characters of it and see if it'll let you in. I bet it will. Because their system is fucking stupid. And that it will let you type in as long a password as you want, and then it truncates it to 11 characters and stores those 11 characters as your password. So when you actually try to use it, it doesn't truncate it. It sends the whole thing and says, you didn't type your password correctly. It's like, how the flying fuck would you know that they had only used the first 11 characters? I figured it out by yelling at one of those support people over the phone. Until he finally explained it to me.
Damn.
And I'm like,
the fact that you could get a person on the phone.
Are you? You know how persistent I can be when I feel I've been.
Oh, I know, dude. I've done the same, man. I mean, I
told you about my issues with the contractor and the fact that I finally got my money back.
So. I'm the same. When I had to get the home phone fixed, and they tried to tell me I had to have a mobile phone to get a home phone fixed. Explaining that one to them was very, very challenging, and hours on the phone.
So.
Got a lot of Diablo 3 played that day.
Let's blaze through these last articles because they're all funny. Well, actually, this one's not funny, but this one's from Ars Technica. Or you sent me this story. Researchers find deliberate backdoor in police radio encryption algorithm. For more than 25 years, the technology used for the critical data and voice radio communications around the world has been shrouded in secrecy to prevent anyone from closely scrutinizing its security properties for vulnerabilities. But now that it's now finally getting a public airing thanks to a small group of researchers in the Netherlands who got their hands on its viscera and found serious flaws, including a deliberate backdoor. The backdoor, known for years by vendors that sold the technology, but not necessarily by customers, exists in an encryption algorithm baked into radios sold for commercial use in critical infrastructure. It's used to transmit encrypted data and commands in pipelines, railways, the electric grid, mass transit, and freight trains. This is mostly in Europe, by the way. I don't think the States is using this one, at least not much. It would allow someone to snoop on communications, learn how a system works, then potentially send commands to radios that could trigger blackouts, halt gas pipeline flows, or reroute trains. Do you remember when cell phones first came out and you had all these signs saying, don't use your cell phone in this area?
Yeah.
That's because there are a lot of industrial systems that are tied together via FM, usually VHF or UHF frequencies, and it's in the commercial space, so it's usually not stuff you're going to hit with your ham radio unless you Mars mod it. But people didn't know how cell phones worked at the time, and they were afraid that your cell phone was going to interfere with that FM radio network, which I guess, depending on how well the cell phones made, it could, and cause problems. And that's exactly why. Researchers found a second vulnerability in a different part of the same radio technology that is used in more specialized systems sold exclusively to police forces, prison personnel, military, intelligence services, and emergency services, such as the C-2000 communication system used by the Dutch police, fire brigade, ambulance services, and Ministry of Defense for mission-critical voice and data communications. The flaw would let someone decrypt encrypted voice and data comm and send fraudulent messages and spread misinformation. So basically, they could decrypt the key and then actually do injections in real time. Three Dutch security analysts discovered the vulnerabilities, five in total, in a European radio standard called TETRA, Terrestrial Trunked Radio, which is used in radios made by Motorola, Dom, Hytra, and others. The standard has been used in radio since the 90s, but the flaws remained unknown because the encryption algorithms used in TETRA were kept secret until now. The technology is not widely used in the U.S., where other radio standards were more commonly deployed, but Caleb Mathis, a consultant with the Ampere Industrial Security, conducted open-source research for Wired and uncovered contracts, press releases, and other documents showing TETRA-based radios are used in at least two dozen critical infrastructure in the U.S. Because TETRA is embedded in radios supplied through resellers and system integrations like Power Trunk, it's difficult to identify who might be using them and for what. So this is low-level stuff. This is kind of like finding a bug in, like, SSL. You know, you remember what a big deal, you know, what a big deal it is whenever that happens. But Mathis helped Wire, identify several electrical utilities, a state border control agency, an oil refinery, chemical plants, and a major mass transit system on the East Coast, three international airports that use them for communications among security and ground crew personnel, and a U.S. Army training base. So I'm going to summarize the rest of the article because it's pretty long. TETRA is pretty old. They've got a few different levels of it in their standards of encryption. It generally is set up to use an 80-bit key for encryption of the signal going out. So it's a digital rate. So it encodes digitally and then encrypts using an 80-bit key. But TEA1, which is like the first level of TETRA, I think can be set to use a 32-bit key, which on today's hardware you can brute force in like a few minutes. you know, just like with any laptop. And if you've got a GPU array, it's like nothing, you know. So, and they found flaws in a bunch of this stuff. And you have to remember, these things were found in, you know, these things were written in the 90s. So it's not surprising they're finding flaws in it. But here's the real problem. And the way the researchers got the algorithms and got the code to research it, they couldn't get it from any of the companies that make these Tetra radios because they wanted all these non-disclosures, and basically they tie them up legally so they couldn't research it. So they went and bought the radio? They went and bought the radio secondhand and then probed it with a multimeter and a scope to find the enclaves where the stuff was stored and dump out the firmware, which is awesome. But yeah, they've been able to, you know, they were able to crack it pretty good. Here's the thing. So, and I've been getting into radios this past year, so I'm learned about this. This isn't something you can patch. You're not going to just go run Windows Update on all your radios and fix the problem. These things are hardware embedded, which means they've got a microprocessor into them, you know, in the body of the radio. And probably burned with what are called security fuses, and what that really is that, or it's one-time write ROMs. Basically, once you write a program to these microcontrollers, which is usually done in the factory, it burns a fuse within the chip so that you can't ever rewrite it. You can't, or the memory technology is such that it's a write once and that's it. You know, it's burning a ROM, literally. So you are talking about a huge deployment of radios that all have this flaw and that there's not going to be a fix for. Maybe some of the newest ones you might be able to apply a firmware update and fix them if they go to update it. But even agreeing on what the fix is going to be a problem because it's across manufacturers. So this vulnerability is going to be in the radio infrastructure for years, if not decades, because you're talking about a lot of hardware that lasts. You know, one of the big complaints I have with some of my ham radio stuff is you don't see, even brand new radios coming out, you don't see a lot of the modern hardware that you would see in cell phones or even things like laptops. Getting a radio with a USB port is amazing. Getting one with a USB-C port is like a unicorn. It's like most, even I've got a brand new radio. Well, I say brand new, it's about a year old. But it was a new radio when I came out. It had just been put on the market. It's got a USB mini port. Not a micro, mini. The radio manufacturers do not update their hardware that often. They don't do refreshes that often. So it's not like your cell phone where you swap it out every couple of years, unless you're Madman, in which case it becomes a marathon to see how long you can keep it working, which I applaud, by the way. It's
the back end stops supporting my stuff often before I get the upgrade. That's what drives me.
I mean, you know, okay, my last couple of phone swaps has been because I broke them, but you know, anymore, and of course I did used to try to keep up with the latest and greatest for a while, and then I realized it was silly. There wasn't, you know, because the hardware on them has gotten so much farther than anything you're going to do app-wise. I mean, some of the Android tablets feel kind of chunky, but I think that's more just the interface doesn't scale as well as it should. Anyways, there's no fixing these radios. They have to be replaced. And you're talking about the entire radio infrastructure of most of Europe when it comes to their emergency services, their police, and their fire, that's a problem. So, yeah, this is going to be a big deal.
I think Europe's going to learn the reason why we've been saying no back doors on cell phones, just because of the issues they're going to have with their radios.
So, anyways, this next article I want to hit real quick because it's kind of amusing to me. The SEC now requires companies to disclose cyber attacks in 4 days. And I think that's hilarious because most companies usually won't even know they've been hit with a cyber attack in 4 days. Usually it's more like several months before they figure it out. I understand you can say it's like, oh, well, you know, 4 days within them knowing about it. But the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission has adopted new rules requiring publicly traded companies to disclose cyber attacks within 4 business days after determining their material incidents. According to the Wall Street Watchdog, material incidents are those that a public company's shareholders would consider important in making investment decisions. The SEC also adopted new regulations mandating foreign private issuers to provide equivalent disclosures following cybersecurity breaches. Quote, whether a company loses a factory in a fire or millions of files in a cybersecurity incident, it may be material to investors. Currently, many public companies provide cybersecurity disclosures to investors. Said SEC Chair Gary Gensler today, quote, I think companies and investors alike, however, would benefit if this disclosure were made in a more consistent, comparable, and decision-useful way. Through helping to ensure that companies disclose material cybersecurity information, today's rules will benefit investors, companies, and the markets connecting them. So, yeah, basically the SEC is saying once you know about a breach, you pretty much have 4 days to disclose it, which...
Oh, is this going to be pushing willful blindness?
Yes, it is. That's where I was going with it. I'm just waiting to see how many companies stop monitoring their networks so they don't have to say that they knew about it. Which, granted, that has a whole another range of problems, but, you know, because there are regulations in place about requiring monitoring and compliance and things like that, but it's just like... Yeah, they're apparently...
There's certain industries. I don't think that's global, though.
No, it's the United States, anything publicly traded. So, yeah, the new cybersecurity incident reporting rules are set to take effect in December, or 30 days after being published in the Federal Register. However, smaller companies will be granted an additional 180 days before they are required to provide Form 8K disclosures. So... Yeah, they've actually got a form for it. I'm not sure how this is going to play. I mean, in theory, I like the idea, but you know how this goes when the government gets involved, right? So
they just need to go in and refine it as they find people abusing it. See, the next refinement is requiring monitoring.
Well, they do that through other, you know, ISO standards and things like that. So I just... It's going to be interesting to see how that one plays out. Are you thoughts? You've been quiet.
Yeah, no, just listening. No thoughts on that one.
I'm gonna go with the government is doing good or at least not doing evil with that one.
Okay, fair enough.
Oh, dude, every time the government gets involved with something, they'll find a way to fuck it up.
Okay.
I wish even in my ultimate optimism I could argue with you on that, but I.
Last article, and this one's just funny. Tesla exaggerated EV range so much that drivers thought cars were broken. You know what? Just looking at the clock, I'm going to summarize this one. Yeah, Tesla was advertising ranges and telling people the ranges on their cars were, you know, going to be, you know, 350, 400 miles. People were getting like half that. And so they started making appointments with the Tesla plant factories or the dealerships and service centers to get the car looked at. They're like, hey, I'm not getting the range you guys advertise. Something's wrong here. Apparently, Tesla set up an entire division dedicating to taking those complaints, determining that it's a range issue, and just canceling the appointments.
That's fraud. If you advertise X miles to the gallon, you have to get X miles to the gallon. That's why most car manufacturers of, you know, actual cars that use gas, you know, the real ones, they always underestimate when they're advertising just not to get sued.
Well, let me read the meat of the article here to you. Reuters said it could not determine whether Tesla still uses algorithms that boost in-dash range estimates, but reported that Tesla last year became so inundated with driving range complaints that it created a special team to cancel owners' service appointments. Reuters also noted that automotive testers and regulators continue to flag the company for exaggerating the distance its vehicles can travel before their batteries run out. Tesla Model 3 driver Alexandre Poisson, quote, was sometimes getting less than half, unquote, of his 2021 vehicle's advertised range of 353 miles, particularly in cold weather, leading him to believe that his car had a serious defect, which, yeah, if you're told the car's supposed to go 300...
It does, it runs on battery.
Well, yeah. But if you're told the car should have a range of 353 miles and you're only getting, you know, what, 270? No, that's not half. Well, anyways, you know, if you're getting less than 200, I can see that being like, hey, something's wrong with the battery. So he booked a service appointment for a few months ago, but later received two text messages telling him that remote diagnostics had determined that his battery is fine and then we would like to cancel your visit. The cancellation was in line with instructions Tesla employees had to receive to, quote, thwart any customers complaining about poor driving range from bringing in their vehicles for service, unquote. According to Reuters, quote, last summer, the company quietly created a diversion team in Las Vegas to cancel as many range-related appointments as possible. Diversion team members reported often close to hundreds of cases a week, and staffers were tracked on their average number of diversion appointments per day. Managers reportedly told employees that each canceled appointment saved the company $1,000 while easing pressure on service centers with long waits for service appointments. Managers allegedly told employees in late 2022 to stop running remote diagnostic tests of vehicles of owners who had reported range problems, speeding up the problem of canceling cases. Thousands of customers were told there was nothing wrong with their car by advisors who never even ran the diagnostics. Reuters quoted a source as saying, advisors offered tips to customers on how to increase their mileage by changing their driving habits. You're holding it wrong. According to Reuters, supervisors also told employees to call a customer once and close the case as unresponsive if no answer. When customers did respond, advisors were told to try to complete the call in no more than 5 minutes. So, fairly standard case
resolution. That's kind of standard call centers.
So, but yeah, I mean, that's, you know, they know there's nothing wrong. They just, you know, fucking lied in the ads. So, it's just, you know, wow. I don't know how you respond to that.
That's a class action fucking lawsuit. Not a frivolous one.
Yeah, I have a feeling that we're going to start seeing that if more of these articles come out. Or Tesla suing the quote-unquote ex-employees making the posts to try to keep them from getting them sued for false advertising.
Oh, no different God. To what Volkswagen did with their emissions testing.
Mm-hmm. I remember that. Yeah, Volkswagen did have a thing try to detect when they were being tested and give different numbers. So, my
it's
car's
the
funny.
Timing on the car, I believe, didn't it?
Yeah, my car's funny. It's got a knob on it, so I can just set it to eco mode if I have to get it emissions tested, and then put it back into sport when I'm done. So, of course, I haven't had to do an emissions test in years, so I don't know if they'd get on you for doing that. All right, let's quickly do this because we're past time. What I have for Digital Dojo tonight is a blog post I found from 2021 of how to unlock an old Chromebook Pixel. This is the one with the square screen, and install Ubuntu on it. This is important to me because I have one of these things. Found it in my stack of old machines when I was going through one of the closets the other day. I'm like, what can I do with this thing? Because the screen on it's actually still in pretty good resolution. The hardware in it's not that far gone. Chrome OS won't do shit on it because it's, you know, it says, oh, this thing's too old. So it's like, well, I've hacked other Chromebooks so you can put Linux on them. Surely you can do it with this. And yep, when I found this is it. So You can still get these things super cheap on eBay. So just a nice little write-up if you want to pick up one of these things and load it up with a lightweight Linux or Ubuntu or whatever and get some life out of it. Or if you find one in a closet like I did. Anyways, that's all I got for tonight. Of course, listen to the stream. We're always working on it. Peer decking every Thursday in the IRC tonight. CyberLard, Psychrost, and myself. Madman, closing thoughts.
Is it just me, or is it crap that your hardware won't try to run something when you tell it to? It'll decide that it can't? I remember when you could tell a computer to do something impossible, and it would at least try.
I might have damaged computers by telling them that they can run faster than they could. So,
a clocking your machine can damage things?
No.
Tell me no, that's not true.
But it's not that I have a problem with the computer saying it can't do something, like, if it actually can't. What I have a problem with is the time box. Once a Chromebook hits a certain age, Google flags it as not supported anymore and just flat out refuses. I mean, you can load whatever that version of Chrome OS was on it, but it just flat out refuses to do anything for you. So, and it just has a little warning on it. Hey, this isn't supported. You've got to go buy a new one. And it's literally because your hardware is too old. Not that it won't do the job, because these Chromebook Pixels, these things were top of the line. Like, these were like those $1,000 Chromebooks when Chromebooks first was a thing. So it's like, yeah, they're kind of getting a little crusty today, but you want to load up a Linux on them and still get some life out of them, you ought to have the option to do that. I also found a MacBook Air when I was going through the stack of hardware, and at least its system tries to load up the it's got an internet recovery built into it. It at least tries to load up. I had to get an SSD adapter for the thing, because God forbid they use a standard fucking M2 socket. But anyways, got it up and running. And yeah, it's kind of crusty on the hardware, but it's at least letting me do what I want, which is amusing that the fucking Apple machine is more open than the Chromebook. So anyways, I was digging through the old machines because I was wanting to see if I could build some beater machines to throw in radio boxes. Because, if I'm out in the field and I crack a 10-year-old MacBook in half, I'm not going to be that upset about it. But if I take my nice gaming laptop out in the field and crack it in half, I'll be upset. So, but, it's really annoying that not, because it's not whether, the hardware just side out says, no, too old, can't operate. That shit pisses me off. If the hardware says can't do that and it really can't do that, fair game, right? That's not a problem. That's just preventing the user from, doing something stupid. But, if it's just an arbitrary thing, apparently printer cartridges do that too, like ink cartridges. Like, they've got a chip in them that, like, after so many print jobs, they say they're empty, no matter what, ink they've actually still got in them. So, that kind of shit's bull. I should probably finish out the show. Are you? Closing thoughts?
I have nothing, man. I got nothing this week. At least you can hit the buttons.
All right, let's hit the buttons.
Tom's going nose down and call it a night.